Welcome to the Country Squire podcast, Red Trousers. My name is Dominic Whiteman, and I am here with...
Jamie Foster.
The format of this, our eighth Red Trousers podcast, is as simple as ever. We split the half-hour podcast into three 10-minute sections and deal with three separate subjects. To decide on the subjects, we have a bucket in front of us of Country Squire readers' questions, balls of scrunched-up paper, which will be randomly picked out of the bucket by Jamie's butler, Basil. Jamie and I will then address the question until, after 10 minutes have passed, we will hear this awful sound and we will shut up and move on to the next question. So, without further ado, Basil, will you please pass Jamie the first question? Thank you, Basil.
So, the first question is from David Bryan. If Remainers thwart Brexit and the UK remains within the EU, would they then likely push for integration, such as joining the Euro or Schengen? What do you think, Dom?
Thank you very much, David Bryan, for your question. So, Remainers, obviously Remainers are 48% of the nation, so that covers quite a few different views and different people. But if you look at the political Remainers, particularly the Labour ones, so we're thinking Blair, Brown, those kind of characters. They were never, as far as I can remember, pushing to join the Euro, although they dabbled with the idea at times. And they never considered joining Schengen, apart from in 2000. But then it was considered by them just to be too politically explosive. So on one level, to David's question, I'd say unlikely that if the Remainers got their way and thwarted Brexit, the UK would be part of the EU and then push further. So push for the Euro or Schengen. And then there's obviously the other element of this question, which is looking at it more generally. This is the sort of nation state versus globalism question.
Yeah.
But should we deal with the first issue?
Yeah. The other part of this, presumably, is that the EU and Schengen are both projects which are under considerable pressure themselves. The economies of Greece and Spain and Italy are still in dreadful situations. So the ability for the EU to sustain itself as a currency over the midterm is going to be in question. It would be foolhardy, wouldn't it, to think that we ought to join a currency that may not even exist itself.
Yeah, but these Remainers are very pro-Euro.
Yes.
They were very pro-Euro until 2004, when all the new countries joined the EU.
Yeah.
After which, actually, Labour became anti-Euro.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and I think they knew there was a... I remember at the time it was Philip Gould did some paper on how the Euro was such a big... joining the Euro, such a big step for the UK. It would require a referendum in itself.
Yeah.
And from all their research at the time, they absolutely knew they'd lose a referendum on the Euro.
Yeah.
They presumed they'd win an EU referendum, but not one on the Euro.
Sure.
So just from a practical standpoint, I don't think it's feasible.
No, and Schengen as well is under considerable pressure from countries like Hungary, who aren't interested at all in the sort of immigration and free movement that the EU stands for.
Sure.
But it would be an extraordinary thing, wouldn't it, that the majority of the country, the 52%, voted for out, and people were pressing for us to join Schengen and join the Euro, the complete opposite of what the referendum result entailed.
Absolutely. I just don't think there's the numbers of people who are pro-Euro in the UK.
No.
To ever, for us ever to join the Euro. It may change in future, but I don't think there are. I mean, Heseltine talked about it for some time, didn't he?
Yeah.
But you look at the thinkers, in inverted commas, in Labour, and you think of Ed Balls when he was an FT leader writer. The FT was pro-Euro, and yet he used to write the leader column as anti-Euro.
Yeah.
So I can't see that there's the movers and shakers within the remaining group to ever
push
demand
that.
Yeah, exactly. Schengen, again, Britain's a unique entity, isn't it? Again, I don't think that Schengen would be embraced by the public. It's still too politically explosive.
Yeah.
Immigration's the main driving force behind the, one of the main driving forces behind the referendum in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely.
But in terms of this question, which I think, I don't know whether this is what David's getting at, but in terms of the wider argument, don't you see his question more as a sort of philosophical question? This is a question between, you know, nation state and globalism. That the Remainers, a lot of the Remainers, the political Remainers, are the type of people who would like to see nation states evaporate and for us all just to get closer and closer together.
Yeah, yeah.
So what's your feeling there? I mean, David's question, if Remainers thwart Brexit and the UK remains within the EU, would they then likely push for integration such as joining the Euro or Schengen? Yes, probably in the sense, the philosophical sense, that nation states are passé.
Yeah, but that exposes a problem at the heart of Europe, doesn't it? Which is that although there is this push for globalism, although there is this push to, in a way, end nation states, the EU was never a formula that was particularly well suited to achieving that end for all sorts of reasons, the euro being one of them. It is a currency that's always been in trouble since the day it was born, hasn't it?
Yeah. Again, the nation state's not been around that long.
No.
As a sort of form of state organization, we're looking at what, 100 and 150 years, something like that. Before then, most of the world was ruled by empires, so colonial ones such as ours, the British, or territorial such as the Russian one. Yeah. And the EU, to Brexiteers, is a territorial empire, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely.
So do you think nationhood, as we know, will be obsolete? Do you think these, the globalists within the remaining parties, will get their way?
I find it hard to believe in the short or medium term that the nation state will evaporate, because there's still so much difference between nation states. If they were all more similar, if we had more similar democracies and more similar economies and more similar cultures and ways of thinking, then you could see the blend being more easily achieved. But even in Europe, the differences are still remarkable. And one of the drivers behind Brexit was the fact that we feel different in this country to the countries that we were being attached to through the EU.
Sure. I think the thing with nation states is that previous forms of state organization of empire failed.
Yes.
And the EU is harking back to that in so many ways.
Yes.
Even if it didn't start out as that idea, it has become more of that idea. And people tend to forget what the benefits of nation states have been. You know, I'd boil it down to sort of three great advantages from previous states' organization. So you've got lack of sort of centralized dictatorship, which has enabled societies and economies to develop. They've been made possible by a form of sort of economic prosperity, which does not depend on the ownership of land, but on trade, industry, capital investment. And enormously greater economic added value of that prosperity has created in each state a civil society, which adopted a cultural self-identity, which we call nationality. So in a nation state, nationality is the source of legitimacy in its political system. The EU seeks to water down nationality, and it's proven itself a successful currency in the past, nationality, in terms of liberating people from this idea of land as power and creating more freedom. It's very worrying at the moment that you have these characters like Blair and Bill Clinton declared himself a citizen of the world first. The idea of nation states being kicked into touch. But surely Brexit, Trump, a lot of the rise of these parties in Italy, nationalist, an ugly term because it reflects errors of the past, but surely these are all symptoms of a rise of people supporting the nation state idea.
Certainly.
And for the last 2 years, which for the first time in the last 30, globalists are taking it in the neck of it. Huh? How do you see that going?
If it's a pendulum swinging, it's certainly, as you say, swinging back the other way. I can't personally see a world coming together in anything like a short or medium term. There's still too many countervailing problems with different cultures and different factions to bring that unity together.
But we are witnessing the emergence of sort of transnational elites, no?
Yes, but they've always been there, haven't they? And prior to empire, there were people who were rich in this country felt much closer to people who were rich in France or Italy than they did to their own people who were here.
Yeah.
That's always been an element of human society.
And surely, Jamie, I mean, squashing different nations into one bigger one doesn't automatically result in peace, lasting peace. I mean, you know, witness the fate of the Soviet Union. We don't want to see wars of secession in Europe, but who knows what the next 40 years might bring. Yeah?
No, absolutely.
Better be out of it. Anyway, David, thank you very much. I'm sorry if we've gone slightly off topic on that one, but I think we've given an answer to your question. Basil, do you think you could be so kind as to pass Jamie the second question?
Thank you, Basil. So the second question is from Country Squire reader Michelle Willis. In 2017, should a Catholic with Neanderthal views on abortion and gay marriage become PM?
Right, so as someone taught by the Benedictines, I can tell you what the Catholic teaching on abortion is, and the Catholic Church's view on gay marriage, which is both unchanged and unchangeable. No circumstance, no purpose, no law whatsoever can make licit an act which is, according to the Catholic faith, intrinsically illicit, since it's contrary to the law of God, basically. And that's the ruling on abortion, and that's the ruling on gay marriage as well. So even recently, Pope Francis, who's considered to be a moderniser, held various synods, and in those synods, the synod fathers observed that for proposals to place unions between homosexual persons on the same level as marriage, there are absolutely no grounds at all for considering homosexual unions to be in any way similar or even remotely analogous to God's plan for marriage and family between man and woman. So that's really very clear, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I did see this interview of Jacob Rees-Mogg, which the question clearly refers to, on Good Morning Britain. And he managed, he was eloquent as ever. He said, look, you know, I'm a Catholic and this is what my faith says. And he was interrupted several times, but managed to be eloquent and slight of foot as usual in the interview. And he ended up trying to say, look, if I ever became prime minister, it's a question of secularism. It all boils down to that. And therefore, I would not, as prime minister, seek to rewrite the laws on abortion or gay marriage in the UK.
Because they already exist.
Because they already exist, exactly. Yeah.
Which goes to the heart of the question, doesn't it? Should such a person become PM? Well, if he's already stated that these views are not going to affect the way that he acts as PM, then that might be part of an answer to that question, that shouldn't be a bar to him becoming a prime minister.
Yeah, I mean, should a Muslim become mayor of London?
Yes, for the same reasons.
Yeah, Muslims regard abortion as wrong and haram.
Yes.
Although I think some accept it may be permitted in certain cases. They're a bit more fluid on the rules because they don't have so much of a hierarchy within their religion. And again, on homosexual acts, Islamic scholars, based on teachings of the Quran and Sunnah, say it clashes with natural order in which God created human beings, the punishments for which are severe.
Yes.
And Sadiq Khan is mayor of London.
Yes. And the truth is that even if a PM with such views were to emerge, there'd never be the numbers within Parliament to make the sort of changes that would reflect the Catholic position, because Prime Minister or not, he would need vote in the House to make law that would change that position, and it's just not going to happen.
In many ways, even though Sadiq Khan is Mayor of London, he previously was a minister, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well,
Shadow Minister.
I think he was also a minister, wasn't he, in Brown's government?
Was he?
I think so. But whether he was or wasn't, a Muslim becoming a minister or prime minister in the UK is more of a threat in terms of theocracy than a Catholic. You've got in the Bible, Mark 12:17, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. Whereas in the Quran, you don't.
No.
The overriding rules are those of Sharia. Therefore, having a Muslim mayor of London is surely, or a Muslim MP or minister, is much more of a threat in terms of theocracy. So all these lefties like Gary Lineker and so forth, who are saying, well, that's the end of Rees-Mogg ever becoming prime minister, they're talking nonsense.
They're certainly writing off a huge swathe of people who would be affected by the same decision. Presumably it's a matter of pragmatism, that if somebody is so fundamentalist that they say their beliefs will dictate the way that they behave, then they would maybe bar themselves from that high office. But if, like Rees-Mogg, they say, I have these views, however, I have a pragmatic position on secularism, then they're in a different boat, aren't they?
They are. And we also, one forgets that now, after a lot of EU immigration, the Catholics are the largest religious body in the United Kingdom. Why shouldn't there be a Catholic Prime Minister?
No, there's no reason.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, as long as you don't take your religion into your politics, you're okay.
Yeah.
So it goes back again to Mark 12:17, you render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, you know? Or as Rees-Mogg would no doubt say, rede Caesari quae sunt Caesaris. Yeah? But I think you didn't see the interview, did you?
No, I didn't see the interview.
I thought he handled it incredibly well. Very difficult one.
In a sense, it's the typical attack, isn't it, on somebody who's showing signs of promise and potential as a prime minister, or potential as a leader, or potential as someone who people want to get behind. The thing to do is now to attack them, to find some sneaky question which is going to make their lives more difficult, and this is exactly what this is.
Yeah, I mean, Good Morning Britain's got its eyes on ratings, and Piers Morgan and Susanna, I don't remember her name,
Reed,
they obviously want to create a story, but their attempts to farron Rees-Mogg failed.
Yes,
he managed to get around it, and actually the support across social media afterwards was shockingly large.
Yeah,
the usual suspects were there whining about him, saying, you know, this is a disgrace, and hey, all our hard-fought rights for abortion and so forth. You know, there's one point which I'll bring up, which is the left. Abortion is definitely the issue of the left.
Yeah.
But if you look at the issue of abortion, it's a fairly grim issue.
Yeah.
I mean, there are scenarios within which one must feel complete sympathy for women who've been raped and have abortions and so forth. But the way that sometimes the left speaks about abortion, they you know, going, abortion is great, you know, it's sort of, abortion is great, we've got, abortions are right, you know, it's as though it's a good thing.
Yeah,
I mean, at the end of the day, you know, abortion is a horrible thing. You know, it's not something you should be cheering from the rooftops, whatever your views upon it.
No, but here's the other thing which is partly aligned to that, which is that in a mature democracy, it must be possible to have the belief that somebody has the right to do something, even though you fundamentally disagree with that thing.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that's the position that Rees-Mogg is putting across. The new politically correct view is that you have to believe what everybody else believes, which is quite dangerous.
Yeah.
As long as you have the tolerance to say, I don't believe in this thing, but you have the right to do it in this society, because that's the way democracy has taken us, and that's the law as it is. So I support your right to do something, but I still fundamentally disagree with the thing that you choose to do. Mm. That must be a more sensible position. than requiring somebody to believe in something that they don't necessarily believe in.
Absolutely. I mean, you look at the Corbynites' response to Rees-Mogg's interview, and they consider that they have seen Rees-Mogg farrand.
Yeah.
They think that he's finished.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of jubilation there, which I think is completely misplaced. He yeah. clearly got away with it, I think. And he avoided the farrand bullet.
Mostly because there's going to be a lot of people who think, even if they disagree with him, it's nice to hear somebody of principle.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, he's a loyal, faithful, honest chap. Yeah. Anyway, there is nothing more foolish than a foolish laugh. I'll throw a Catullus at you. That's the way to treat these Corbynites. So thank you very much, Michelle Willis, for the last question. Now, the final question. Basil, if you could pass me the last question, that'd be jolly kind of you. Thank you, Basil. So the final question is from Nicholas Parr from Kirby Moorside. Was Sir Chris Hoy correct with his comments about Lycra?
On one view, the answer to this is yes, of course he was.
Well, should we discuss what he actually said?
Yes.
Okay. So this was an article in GQ magazine in which Sir Chris Hoy, national hero cyclist, said Lycra was not the most elegant material, and that professional cycling gear generally looked bad on anyone heavier than 8 stone. He also said the desire of so-called mammals, middle-aged men in Lycra, to be seen in the latest high-performance Team Sky cycling kit all too often led to ridiculous results. Personally, I feel sorry for mammals, he wrote. When they walk into a cafe dressed head-to-toe in Lycra, you always spot people sniggering at them. They're terribly unflattering. From the front, men look like a percentage sign and become see-through when wet. Enough said. So yes. There we are. Yeah.
And it's true, isn't it? Lycra is an unfortunate material that is hardly flattering on anyone at all. It's easy to see, however, why so many people have got behind it. With the rise of British cycling and the amazing achievements of Sir Chris Hoy and Bradley Wiggins and others, who have moved British cycling on to the point that they have. It's people have become swept up with the emotion of cycling. It's an incredibly healthy activity. It's an incredibly green activity. So people can feel very good about themselves doing it. Yeah. And once you start something like that, you want to be dressed like the people that you admire and the heroes who are taking cycling to new levels.
Yeah. Can you just sort of clarify your position on cycling? You have a rather expensive road bike, do you not?
I do have a bicycle. I haven't ridden it for some time.
Do you own Lycra?
I have got some Lycra, although I must say, as Chris Hoy rightly points out, I'm not one of the people who looks best in it.
Right. And I'll just put my cards on the table. I bought a hybrid bicycle. I do not own Lycra. I only bought the bicycle because I got a terribly bad knee, which... cycling is useful for making better. But I'm not at all against cycling. And having insulted a nation last month, we need to be slightly careful about what we're talking about, because cycling is booming in Britain.
It's huge.
With more than 2 million people across the country now riding their bikes at least once a week, which is an all-time high, according to British Cycling. So let's be slightly careful what we say here. Yeah?
There's also a split, I think, in cycling, between cycling in cities and cycling in the countryside. Mm. Cycling in cities tends to involve more aggressive people doing things which get into the way of pedestrians and cause those sort of problems because of the limited space available in cities and the amount of cars moving through them. In the countryside, it tends to be more the people that Chris Hoy is describing, middle-aged men going out on weekends for long rides.
Yeah.
And although they can be annoying to motorists as a sort of mobile chicane.
Mm.
They are, by the same token, less aggressive and simply doing it for the health benefits.
Yeah, no comment. I mean, I have no issue with regards to cyclists on bikes wearing Lycra. But it's when they sort of, you know, storm into a cafe or even restaurant wearing Lycra in the countryside normally. Where you do think, you know, couldn't you sort of put on a pair of trousers or something. I mean, you know, you might sort of hang around in your sweaty spandex or compression shorts after working out, you know, after rugby training or whatever. But you don't go out into the bar wearing it. You know, you have a shower and you put on a pair of trousers.
Yeah.
Yeah? Wouldn't you?
Well, we had that experience recently, didn't we, of sitting in a cafe in Honiton.
We did, yes.
Being completely surrounded by slightly sweaty men in Lycra.
We did, exactly. But, I've also been on the end of coach loads of sort of octogenarians showing up, and, you know, one of them had an issue with their, I don't know how to put it politely, their gas. And again, I'm not a proctologist, but whatever that noise was, it put me off my spaghetti bolognese, you know? Should one complain that these groups of people, however they're dressed, show up in a free society in a cafe or restaurant?
Ultimately, no. It's a nice thing, isn't it, to think that these people are going out cycling around, enjoying each other's company and enjoying the wonders of British countryside.
Yeah. I mean, we listened, didn't we, to the conversations when that huge sort of posse of cyclists showed up in their Lycra. Some were women, some were guys. And the conversations were all about cycling.
Yes.
Isn't there, I mean, as a non-cyclist, isn't there an element of nerdiness about these cyclists?
Well, of course there is. And in a way, that's part of their charm, isn't it? That they've been enthused by a particular activity and they've given it their all. It's quite nice to see the passion that goes into them expressing their found way of life.
Right. So when you see a sort of fit, tanned, lycra clad young woman ride by, the first thing you're looking at is the bicycle or the woman?
It tends to be the bicycle, yes.
And you wear your sort of heart monitor to bed to make sure you stay within your target zone during any extracurricular activities. I mean, you know, I ride my hybrid bike. I would not think of buying Lycra, but that's just me. I mean, I don't know. I wear a sort of dustman's high-vis jacket and no one really complains. But
I think you should wear tweed.
Tweed.
Tweed is a good material for cycling.
Yeah, yeah.
It's much better with the British weather.
It is unflattering, but I mean, you wear this stuff. So you wear it, why? Because A, you don't really care. Yeah. B, it's comfy and warm.
It's incredibly comfortable to wear on a bicycle because it's the material that's most suited to riding a road bike.
And presumably it weighs less than normal clothes.
Absolutely.
Is that a factor?
Yeah.
And it dries off faster. So if you're in England cycling or Britain cycling and you get wet, it's useful to be wearing something that dries off faster.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So was Sir Chris Hoy correct with his comments about Lycra, or was he being tongue-in-cheek, trying to wind people up and sell magazines, or was he being incredibly offensive?
I think he was just smiling at what is an amusing factor.
Yeah. So, I mean, and Sir Chris Hoy has rights within cycling. This guy's a god within cycling.
Absolutely.
He has the right to say what the hell he wants, right?
He's one of the reasons so many people are wearing Lycra. So, of course, he's got the right to say what he likes.
Right. So if it had been someone like, I don't know, Gary Lineker commenting about Lycra, then he has absolutely no right and he'd be being offensive, yeah?
I'm not going to go down that road. It's a hypothetical.
And as one, do you feel sorry for mammals?
I would hardly call myself a mammal, frankly. I'm more likely to be found in a comfy chair with a cup of tea than I am with some Lycra.
Right, okay. So I think we've pretty well covered that topic, do you think?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. Well, that brings us to the end of our 8th Country Squire magazine podcast. Thank you very much for listening. And please do remember to use our Twitter accounts for feedback. If you have a question for one of the upcoming episodes, then please do let us know. Special thanks this week go to users of the contact form on the Country Squire website who continue to send in questions and answers in a bid to keep us amused. So let's thank Lance Stringer, who asked, "Why can't you hear a pterodactyl in the bathroom?" Because it has a silent P. And Naomi King, who emailed us with the question, "What did the little fish say when he swam into a wall?" Damn. And finally, Alan Alexander, who wrote, "Dear Squires, would you know where does a sheep go for a haircut? To the bar shop. Can I just say, keep these attempts at humour coming in. They lighten our day and help us understand there are some remarkably bored people in this world. You can contact us through the Country Squire magazine website or on Facebook or Twitter or by email at editor@countrysquiremagazine.co.uk. We really look forward to hearing from you, however inane or insane your message might be.
Many thanks for listening. In the light of the humour that we've had so far, can I just ask, what's a seal's favourite drink? Canadian Club on the Rocks.
Oh, dear me.
So, thank you, Basil, for your assistance. Also, thanks, Dom, for the banter. I'll look forward to the next podcast, which we'll try to do every few weeks and publish on the magazine.
So, that's bye from me.
And that's toodle-pip from me. Till we meet again.
Goodbye.